What I want to talk about a bit now is random processes. So we have a few more theoretical hurdles we have to get through here. So far what I've done is I've talked about signal processing as if the signals are these nice functions which were defined, say, by us or by God. Nice deterministic functions. But actually one of the key things that we care about is noise. I've talked about noise a little bit, but I haven't actually told you really what I mean by noise. I haven't given you any sort of firm foundation in understanding what noise is. So we're going to talk a little bit about random processes now, because we need to know a bit about random processes to really understand noise. I have a couple of little extra references here if you have trouble following some of the stuff. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. It's pretty basic stuff in some ways, but there are a whole lot of interesting side avenues of research going on in this sort of area. So, you know, feel free to ask questions for a start. It's one thing I perhaps haven't said often enough to you. You're allowed to ask questions in class, and do so if you have something you don't understand. So we want to talk about random processes, and I'm going to restrict my attention with random processes to looking at random processes in time. So a random process in time, discrete time I should say, is just a vector. And it's a random vector, by which I mean I have some vector x, where each of the components of that vector is a random number. Now you know various ways of generating random numbers. For instance, you can roll a dice. That will generate a random number for you. Or you can do the lotto. That will generate some random numbers for you. The output of the lotto, some six numbers perhaps, that's like a random vector. So that would be a random vector with six numbers. So we can say just a random vector, or we can think of this as a time series. We can think of it as a process where this index here indicates time, this is the starting point, and we go along. Typically in my notation, when I mean a random number, I'll use a big letter like this, and its value I will often give a little value. So as soon as we have this random vector, we have to talk about how we create this random vector, what its statistics are, and so on. To define it correctly, we have to define this thing called the distribution functions, all of the distribution functions. So I have a definition of the distribution functions here. This function x of xn, xn plus 1, some combination of these n's, is the probability that big Xn is less than or equal to little xn. Big Xn plus 1 is less than or equal to little xn plus 1, and so on. Now if I tell you all of these guys, then you know how to generate those random numbers. You know all of their behavior. You'll be able to characterize them. You'll be able to uniquely describe them. Even though they're random numbers, you know their behavior. You know something about their behavior. They're not complete unknowns. But there's an infinite number of these distributions, and it's quite hard to tell you all of them. So most of the time we don't do it that way. Most of the time we define something a bit simpler. We define some simple characteristic of this process, and we use that to characterize it. So a standard example of this is white noise. In white noise, we say that each of these guys is independent. So they have no correlation. We don't have to write down all of these distribution functions. All we need to know is the distribution function of each of the individual elements. Once you have a distribution function, one of the natural sort of things to define is a density. It's typically defined as the derivative of the distribution function. Its meaning you can think of as f of x dx, being the probability that your random number is in the range x to x plus dx, where dx is some small number. That's a sort of intuitive view of it. There are cases where this thing doesn't exist. Imagine this derivative doesn't exist. We can deal with those cases in probability. We have to do some advanced measure theory though, so I'm not going to do it today. I just want you to get an idea of the sorts of notation that we use here. And I should say again, I'm going through this very quickly, so if you have a problem, do come and see me or look at the references and so on. Why do we define these things? Well, the sorts of quantities we want to know about our random numbers are typically things like the mean or the average. That just tells you, you know, the average value of you're going to get out of it. It's a very useful quantity in a lot of cases. Another thing that we might want to know is the variance. The variance tells us how much does that random variable vary around its mean. If the variance is very small, then the value is almost always at that mean, and it's almost deterministic. If the variance was zero, it would be deterministic. If the variance is very big, then it can be all over the place, all over, you know, anywhere. So how do we work them out? Well, firstly, the notation I'm going to use mu of x to tell you the mean of x at time n. And another way of writing that is the expected value of x at time n. E stands for expected value. The variance I'm going to write as sigma squared, and I'm going to denote that as the variance of xn. Notice the time index is still in here. And these are just the formal definitions of those things. Again, you don't really need to know the formal definitions in any great specificity, but you have to have some intuitive idea of what mean and variance actually mean. Covariance tells us something about the correlation between two random variables. So how do you calculate the covariance? Well, you subtract the mean off the variable first. So if it was mean zero, if it was a mean zero process, it would just be the expected value of x times y. But typically we define it like this to take the general case into account. So this is the covariance. It tells us the correlation between two random variables. For a process, we care about the autocovariance. The autocovariance nk is the covariance between xn and xn plus k. So it tells us about correlations between xn and the value with xn plus k. That's k units of time apart. K lags apart. K is the lag between the two. Most of the processes that we will deal with are what we call stationary processes. In fact, just about all of the processes we have to deal with are stationary processes. That just means they don't change if you do a shift in time. It's like the time invariance property for a linear system. Again, it's hard to define all of these distribution functions though, so people typically don't do that. What they typically do is define stationarity in the wide sense or weak sense, or sometimes it's called second order stationarity. And what that means is that these three guys are stationary. That means they don't depend on time, they don't depend on this index n. So the mean is constant, mu of x, the variance is a constant, sigma x squared, and the autocovariance, this guy, doesn't depend on n. The autocovariance only depends on the lag. It becomes a function only of the lag. I'm going through this notation really quickly. Again, a lot of what we need to be able to deal with here is intuitive. You need to understand what these things mean rather than be able to trot out the definitions for me. One of the things that I want you to get a grasp of is the marginal distribution. The marginal distributions of a process are just these distribution functions, any of these distribution functions. But typically when we say the marginal distribution, the implication is that we care about this one. This is the distribution function of any individual value from that time series, from that vector. So classic examples, the Bernoulli process. The Bernoulli process is one where you take a coin, something like this, and you flip it. It comes up a head, you say the Bernoulli process is a 1, comes up a tail, you say it's a 0. Now, you notice that I have a biased coin here. Typical coin, you'd say the probability of a head is 1/2, but we're going to have a coin where the probability of a head is 1 minus p, the probability of a tail is probability p. That's a Bernoulli process. And you can see that the marginal distribution for the Bernoulli process is just 0 or 1 with probability p or 1 minus p, because it's just that one point in time. One of the things about this Bernoulli process is each random variable, each element of our vector is independent. Another way of saying that, the autocovariance is going to be zero. When the autocovariance is zero, it means there's no correlation. Another random process where you roll a dice, say a six-sided dice, the marginal distribution is just the numbers 1 to 6, and each one has an equal probability. Another process which we will deal with and which you have to get some idea of is a Gaussian process. So Gaussian process just means the marginal distributions are Gaussian. Gaussian distribution has a density function which looks like a Gaussian. Remember, we've talked about Gaussians before. A Gaussian is just this thing. So we want a density function now which looks like this. You notice a few things about it. I haven't just got an e to the x squared. I have some extra bits in here, the mean and the variance. So I have these parameters in my Gaussian so that I can change the mean and the variance of that Gaussian distribution. I also have a constant out the front. That constant is to ensure that the integral of this f will integrate to 1. That's just to ensure that probabilities add up to 1. If the probabilities don't add up to 1, then something funny is going on, because, you know, probability, something has to happen. The probability 1, something has to happen. Okay, so Gaussian processes are kind of cool. The reason that we use them, the reason we talk about them a lot, is because they're the linear time invariant systems of the random process world. They are the simple numerically or simple mathematically tractable processes. Why is that? Well, there are a whole bunch of reasons. One is that they're linear. You add two Gaussian processes together, you get a new Gaussian process. There's a thing called the central limit theorem, which means that if I take a sum of any arbitrary random variables, not any, but almost any arbitrary random variables, and add them together, I will get a random variable with a Gaussian distribution. So if I take a series of processes and add them together, I will get a Gaussian process. This is typically why we use Gaussian processes to model noise. What we imagine is that that noise process is usually the sum of a whole lot of little things happening. Remember the tape I talked about yesterday. I talked about the flaws in the magnetic medium on a tape. The flaws in the magnetic medium happen because there are lots and lots of little tiny, tiny molecules, millions of them, 10 to the 23 of them or something. There's a very, very large number of them, of these tiny little things. And some of them are not aligned properly, some of them are aligned properly. So what we're seeing when we look at the noise is the sum over a very, very large number of random, think of them as coin tosses. Think of each little magnetic moment as being a coin toss, whether it's up the right way or not. You flip that coin enough times and you add it together, and you will get something that looks like a Gaussian distribution, very close to it. And that's why we often model noise as a Gaussian process. The other reason, of course, is because it's tractable, mathematically tractable. We can do analysis with Gaussian processes. Why is that? Well, we have two Gaussian processes, X and Y, we add them together, the mean of the process will just be the sum of the means of those two processes. The variances will also sum for a Gaussian process like this. So then you notice that when I take mu of X minus Y, I get a difference in the two means, but the variances add. This will make sense to you if you think about the intuition behind what variance and mean are. So if you can't understand why this is true, you need to think about it a bit. We can generalize this to include the effects of correlations between them. This is for two independent Gaussian processes. We can imagine adding Gaussian processes which are correlated in some way, and we can come up with useful statements about what happens there as well. The other thing is that if you multiply by a scalar, you multiply the means by a scalar here, but you multiply the variances by the square of the scalar. So these simple relationships we're going to use. These are what we're going to use in our analysis of noise. The other thing we're going to use is a thing called the spectral density. The spectral density is the analogy, it's like the power spectrum. But now we're not dealing with a signal, we're dealing with a random process. So with a random process, you know, it's going to have a bunch of random numbers in there. And if we look at the actual power spectrum of that, the power spectrum is also going to be random. Obviously. You take a random number, you do something to it, you transform it, you get a random number. It's going to be a bit different, it's going to have some different properties, but it's still a random number. The spectral density is like the expected value of those random numbers. It's like the expected value of the power spectrum. I'm talking a bit roughly here, but a bit loosely. But that's how I tend to think of it. Think of it as the expected value of this power spectrum. How do we get the spectral density? Well, this is why I introduced the autocovariance. The way we get it is we take the Fourier transform of the autocovariance. So this is just a Fourier transform, but you'll notice that the sum goes from minus infinity to infinity. This assumes that we have an infinite series. And as a result, we calculate this spectral density at an arbitrary real value. We don't just calculate it at a set of discrete points the way we did with our finite Fourier transform. Likewise, we can do an inverse of this spectral density. So the spectral density tells us basically the same thing as the power spectrum. But if you take the spectral density and you look at a process, a particular realization of a process, you won't see that spectral density. You'll see something which varies around the spectral density. Again, there are precise mathematical results for Gaussian processes here. We know what the spectral density will look like for them, and we know what the variations will look like as well. But that goes a bit beyond what we need to know in this course. Various things about it, we know it's non-negative, we know it's going to be even. These are directly in relation to the properties that we had for our power spectrum. We know it's going to be even because our input signal is real. And this important one, the spectral density, the Fourier transform of the autocovariance. The autocovariance is the inverse Fourier transform of the spectral density. I'm sorry about using this notation F, where I've been using this as a function, I've been using it sometimes as frequency. I tend to overload some of the terms here. This is because this little F is often used as spectral density, and lambda is often used for frequency in this context. The context of random processes, the notation is often different from the notation that we've been using so far in our course. So you just have to get used to that, particularly if you're ever going to read any of the sorts of bits of literature on random processes. Now, why is the spectral density the Fourier transform of the autocovariance? Well, it comes down to an idea of time averages versus ensemble averages. When we talk about expectation, we're talking about what we call an ensemble average. We imagine that there's some infinite population out there of random processes, and we want to know the average of all of that population of random processes. But you can't ever see that. Whenever you see a process, you see one process. Or maybe sometimes you're lucky and you get three different versions of that process. Typically, though, you see one. You're listening to my voice, I'm typing it on this little thing, you get one version of that signal. You don't get a whole vast number of them. So we can't do an ensemble average in practice. One of the nice properties, though, is there's a property which says if you have a stationary ergodic process, the time average is going to converge to the ensemble average. What does that mean? That means if I average the process over time, that will converge to the average over this big ensemble. This is a tricky concept. There's no doubt about that. So don't be surprised if this is sort of jumping around in your head a little bit. This is a tricky concept, this idea that a time average converges to an ensemble average. In practice, it's not such a difficult thing to deal with, really. This guy over here, this autocovariance, this is this theoretical quantity. This is an ensemble average. And this is how we would actually measure it in real life. This is an estimator of the ensemble average. And you can see it's a time average. We're taking this index, we're ranging over time, and we're dividing by 1 on n to make it normalized. So this is a time average of this quantity. As n goes to infinity, this thing converges to this for a stationary ergodic process. So let's take the mean zero case. So let's take the case where mu is equal to zero. And I'll write this guy down instead of this thing. I'm going to take the Fourier transform of this guy instead of the... I'm going to take the Fourier transform of the time average instead of the ensemble average. So that's what I have over here. My time average, notice the mu's have disappeared. This is a pretty simple looking thing. What I'm going to do is then rewrite this thing. Instead of n and n plus k, I'm going to use n minus k and n. That's just simply a change in the index value. But you'll notice that this thing, if I put minus n in here, this would just be a convolution. It's a convolution of x with a time-reversed version of x. This is just your standard definition of convolution. Notice that I've dropped the limit here and said this is approximately equal to... This convolution is sort of saying you have an infinite series again, or you've truncated or done something. It's an approximation in some sense. For finite signal. When we take the Fourier transform of a convolution, what do we get? A product. When I ask that question, you should all be able to chant, product. You should know this. The Fourier transform of a convolution is a product. If you don't know it by now, then you have a lot of catching up to do. Fourier transform of a convolution is a product. So the Fourier transform of this guy is the product of the Fourier transforms of these two. This is just the Fourier transform of x is big X. The Fourier transform of the time reverse version of x is x star, the complex conjugate of x. The product of x with its complex conjugate is just the absolute value of x squared. So you can see the Fourier transform of the order covariance just looks like the power spectrum. But there's some approximations going on here. It isn't actually the power spectrum, because the power spectrum, remember, is going to be random. If we put expectations in here, then we can get something that actually works correctly. But then it looks uglier, and I just wanted to give you an intuitive understanding of why this happens. This thing is called the Wiener-Kinchin theorem. And it's one of the fundamental theorems of Fourier analysis. It's one of those things that underlies a lot of what we talk about. So far in this course, I've managed to avoid dealing with this, but we need to know it. You need to have some understanding of this before you go on to be a signal processing person. In practice, it can be very useful to understand this. So let's think about white noise. I've talked about white noise before, uncolored noise. The analogy of white noise is that white light. The idea of white light is there's spectral energy in all of the radiation bandwidth. The orange and red and, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. The whole spectrum, there's light. Actually, white light doesn't have an even spectral representation. There's different amounts of blue and green and so on. White noise, we assume that there's an equal amount of power in all of the spectral bands. Typically, when people say white noise, they mean a Gaussian process that's white, that's uncolored. And that's what I'm typically going to mean as well. But it's not automatic. You can have white noise, white non-Gaussian noise. All white means is this idea that the spectrum is flat. So let's think about that. What I mean is white, I mean the spectrum is flat. I mean there's equal power in all bands. So let's think about that. That's the spectral density. If I take the Fourier transform of that spectral density, what am I going to get? Well, let's think about that. Let's do a little picture. Who remembers what the Fourier transform of a constant looks like? So if this is x of t, and it's a constant, imagine this is my thing, that's a constant, what's its Fourier transform look like? Come on, speak up, someone. A delta function, very good. Just looks like a delta function. So a big spike. So by duality, if this is x of s, what's the signal going to look like? If I have a Fourier transform that's flat, that's a constant, what does its time domain signal look like? Delta function. Okay, take the Fourier transform of a constant, we get a delta. What if this, instead of being our Fourier transform, this is my spectral density? Then over here, I get my autocovariance. What does it mean to say that this is a delta function? Well, the autocovariance here at zero, this is just sigma x squared. It's always going to have some sort of value. It tells you the variance of the process. If you calculate the autocovariance with lag zero, you just get the variance. Here, and everywhere else, it's zero. What does zero mean? Well, it means there's no correlation. There's no correlation between terms. So this is why when I talk about a white noise process, I talk about an uncorrelated process. It means there's no correlation between points at different points in time. That's what white noise is. And this is why. The Wiener-Kinchin theorem tells us why that is. It spells out that relationship for us. So here's an example. This is Gaussian noise. This is a little section of a longer series, and this is its Fourier transform. Now, so this is power spectrum. Now you can see that it's not flat. It goes up and down and up and down and up and down so much that this entire area of the page is just blue. But you can see that if I look, say, at the top, or if I looked through a band here, I would see that it's actually pretty flat. If I look at the average of those points, you get something that's pretty flat. Let's have a listen to some white noise if this actually works. Oh. Okay, you have all heard white noise before. It's just hiss. It's the same thing, it's static. It's the static you get on your TV when it's not tuned into a station. That's the same sort of noise that you get on a tape, although usually it's a bit quieter than that. So white noise is the standard thing that we come across all the time. White Gaussian noise. The spectral density is a really useful thing with white noise. Similar to the way it can characterize a time invariant filter, linear time invariant filter, with its transfer function, the spectral density tells us all we need to know about a Gaussian process. We can characterize a Gaussian process, or we can uniquely define a Gaussian process by knowing its mean, its variance, and its autocovariance. So these things together are all we really need to know about that Gaussian process. And this is one of the reasons with Wiener-Kinchin theorem is helpful to us. The other thing that we need to be able to do is work out what happens to noise when we filter it. This is reasonably easy to do. Firstly, we know what happens in the frequency domain. We take our noise and we filter it. All we're going to have to do is apply the transfer function. So we know what happens to the spectral density. We've already worked that out. The spectral density, we multiply it by the transfer function, and we will get a new spectral density for the noise that we get. We can take the inverse Fourier transform of that spectral density, and we can get the autocovariance. So we know that part of it. We know what happens to the frequency content. All I'm going to do here is work out the mean and variance of our new process. So imagine I have a process or a system or a filter where this is my impulse response, so this is my filtering equation, this is the convolution. Y is just the convolution of W with X. The expectation operator is a linear operator. So if I take the expectation of y, which is a linear combination of the x's, I can just take a linear combination of the expected values. Remember, the w's are not random. The w's are our filter coefficients. We decide them. They're not random. The only random thing are the x's. So all I've done is take my expectation inside this sum and inside the scalar product. Now, the expected value of x, if this is a stationary process, the expected value of x is always equal to mu of x. So I can just take these out. I get mu of x times the sum over the filter coefficients. For real filters, this is always going to be finite. So I can easily work out the mean of my process after filtering. Likewise, I can work out the variance. It's a little bit more complicated, and this formulation only works for independent Gaussian random variables. So if the Gaussian, if they're not Gaussian, or if there's some correlations or something like that, I do have to be a little bit careful. This works for white noise. But if I put white noise in, I can treat this almost like a linear operator, except remember, instead of when I do a scalar multiple, I get the square of the scalar out the front of the variance. This variance will be constant for a stationary process, so I can take it out the front, it's sigma squared, and I get the sum of the square of these filter coefficients. So now I can work out the mean and the variance and the autocovariance of my new process, so I know everything I need to know about that new process.